Okay. Hi, I'm Scott. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Scott.
I've had the pleasure of knowing Andrea for about 16 years. We met, like she said, on the retreat committee, and we became almost instant friends right away. And I mean good friends. And friends like Andrea are really hard to find. We've developed, as far as I'm concerned, a very loving friendship. And I had the pleasure of seeing her come into this recovery 2 years before I did. And that recovery is really something awesome. And I know she's going to have a good story also. And so I'd like to introduce Andrea to come on up.
Hi, everybody. I'm Andrea. I'm an abstinent compulsive overeater.
Hi, Andrea.
And I am so, so happy to be here this weekend. This retreat has opened my eyes yet again to even more recovery and more spirituality. And I am just having the most wonderful time and meeting the most incredible people, you know. And I'm here to talk about my experience, strength, and hope with how I came to the first step. When I first, and then to share my experience, strength, and hope on a physical, emotional, and spiritual level. So I'm hoping I can get all of that in. When I first heard, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. I skipped over that first part because I wasn't powerless over anything. Okay, I had complete control and complete power over everything because that's how I felt I needed to get by. So powerless, no, that's for wimps. So we skipped to the second part of that step. You could tell I was very open-minded at the time. We skipped to the second part of the step, and I saw, and our lives had become unmanageable. And I became angry, and I said, don't these people know anything? And what I was referring to I don't remember my life becoming unmanageable. It seemed like my life had always been unmanageable. I said, does that mean that some of these people had times in their lives where it was manageable? So I was dissecting every little piece of this step. I was having none of this, you know. But I want to tell you about my history. You know, I began compulsively overeating, about age 4 or 5. And my mom was a compulsive overeater, and we ate together. And my father ate and he drank. Alcohol, and we had a lot of addiction in the family. Lost the microphone,
okay,
didn't I?
It should go back on. Hold on, try it.
Okay, no.
My bad. Sorry.
That's okay.
There you go.
There we go. Yeah. You come near the microphone, it goes back on. It's very belligerent, just like me. That's among my defects of character. I do believe I remember my first compulsive bite. My mom was eating something. She gave me a piece. And all of a sudden, I felt like I was starving. And I didn't understand that. And I looked at my mom and I said, can I have another piece? And she said, okay. And it was off to the races from there. My mom and I ate together. And the rule in the house was kind of like, as long as you ate your 3 meals, you could have pretty much whatever you wanted in between. And that was just fine with me, you know. I remember, you know, starting to really grow out of my clothes and my mom having to buy me new clothes at age 6 or 7. You know, like I'm thinking I was around, you know, second grade at the time. By the time I reached the fourth grade, I was about 9 years old and my mom died. And it was a result of her compulsive overeating. She was well over 300 pounds. She had a heart attack and died just like that in her sleep. And she was 38. I can't believe she was 38. And you know, it was the 60s, and you know, back then dads went to work and moms stayed home and took care of the kids. And I have a brother who's 6 years older than I am, and my father continued to go to work, and my mom's aunt and her mother, meaning my grand-aunt and my great-grandmother, lived in the apartment downstairs in our building. And my aunt, who no one realized had mental health issues, took over my upbringing. So at the age of 9, I learned that it was not acceptable to be overweight. She was so freaked out that she lost my mother that in her way she was trying to get me thin so that she wouldn't lose me too. So she, so I started feeling shame at that time, and that's when I started stealing, you know, stealing food and stealing money to go out and buy candy. And you know, it was no longer okay. I had never noticed that I was fat before until it was pointed out to me, you are fat, and it is not acceptable. And so, you know, all during school years, and I'm going to tell you, it was pretty much from the first grade on, I was never able to really pay attention in school up until, you know, except for math class. I don't know what it was, but I would sit down in class. My mom, I would look out the big windows over to the left of me, and I would visualize. I would say, I'm flying out the window, and I literally, my mind just went right out the window. I never heard a word of anything that was taught in school. And the way I got through 12 years of school, basically, was that my aunt believed that we had a lazy child in the family, and you could not let anyone know that the child was lazy. So she did all my work for me. She called up my classmates' moms, found out what was learned in school that day, what the assignments were. She did them. She tried to drum them into my head and kept me up until all hours of the night trying to learn something that I simply could not understand. And then I would go to school the next day, and this went on and on. By the time when I was in the eighth grade, we had a prom, and a girlfriend of mine had broken up with her boyfriend that year, and she told me, you know something, you can take him to the prom. You know, we didn't really care about things like that back then, and he took me to the prom, and he turned out to be a lifetime friend, and so I had a guy to go with, but there, you know, there were no guys coming around me because, you know, and you know something, I wasn't really that overweight. I was bigger in my mind than I really was, but I bet I was overweight. So I got into high school, and I discovered all the cool girls that, you know, sort of like the girls that didn't belong in a clique. And they ate all this really, really wonderful junky stuff, and they never gained weight. Mm-hmm. And here I was always going on a diet and starving and binging and starving and binging. And I said, how are you staying so thin? How could you eat that stuff? And they said, come on, we'll show you. And that they showed me how they lined up in the bathroom, and they took turns throwing up. And, you know, we didn't have a word for it. We didn't know it was called bulimia. We didn't know there was anything wrong with it. We figured this was a great way to eat and get away with it. Well, you know something? I couldn't really do that. I mean, I was always really afraid of throwing up. And, you know, forget about the part that I was already throwing up from alcohol. I mean, that's something you can't help, you know. But to deliberately throw up your food, I mean, come on. So they told me, well, you know, you can try laxatives. And I said, okay. So I started taking laxatives, and I started getting cramps in my stomach, and I don't like pain of any kind. I really don't. And I said, no, this isn't going to work for me. So that was very short-lived, the laxative use. So I got out of high school, and I want to just make a note that there was one teacher in school. I'm going to tell you, I always hated school. And it seemed like I had to go to jail every day, go behind bars, you know, sit there, be tormented, and then I was let loose out of prison at the end of the day. I had one teacher who discovered that I really couldn't write because we had an in-class assignment, and I was basically found out. She said, you know, you're in high school now, and you've got the writing level of a fourth grader. And she said, how did that happen? And I very belligerently, there's that word, said to her, my aunt has always done all my schoolwork for me because I just can't pay attention in school. And she said, well, if you want to learn how to write, I'll stay after school with you and teach you how to write. You know, anytime anybody let me know that they wanted to do something caring for me, I stopped and listened. And I'd cut class all day, but then I would come back at 3 o'clock and I learned how to write because of that teacher. And there was no college for me because I I just couldn't wait to get out. So I made it seem as though, oh no, you guys, you can all go to school. I'm going to work. I'm going to make some money. I'm going to get out of my house so I can be free. That's all I wanted to do, was be free. My father had remarried, and I didn't like the rule about having to be home at 10 o'clock at night. And so I went out to work, and I ended up on a day shift that turned into a night shift, and that's when the compulsive overeating really took off, because I was so isolated. I had basically no social life. You know, so I ate. We would get to work. If we had to work on a Friday night, it was 2 a.m. to 10 a.m. shift. So if I had to work on Friday night, someone was making this and someone was buying that, and then somebody would bring in a bottle, and we'd be eating and drinking all night. And because I was making money, I eventually joined a commercial weight loss plan. And it was a commercial weight loss program that everyone, all of my neighbors in the building had used. They all lost weight. It was wonderful, and it was successful, and I finally had some money of my own. I went and I got this dumpy, crappy looking studio, but it was mine, and I could do whatever I wanted to because I was finally free, meaning I didn't have to answer to anybody, so I could do whatever I wanted by myself. So I, of course, mismanaged all of my money. I ate out every night. Oh, my God. I wasn't cooking. I wasn't cleaning. I wasn't doing anything. There were bugs in that apartment to this day. I can't tell you what they are. They're probably not even in any encyclopedia. I don't know what was going on. I was a complete mess. Because of the foods I was eating, I fell into such deep depressions that I eventually began to smell because I did not get into the shower. I would say, I'll go later, I'll shower tomorrow, I'll wash out of the sink, I'll be fine. But in this course of time, after a while, I got money. I ended up on a day shift somewhere. I always was working in banks because, remember, I could pay attention to math. And my aunt told me, you do what you're good at, you know, you go and get a job at what you're good at doing. And so I went to work in banks, and I had wanted to be a singer. I always loved to sing. I would, you know, sit there with my hand like this, pretending it was a microphone, and I would sing to all my brother's 45s. And my aunt, having come through the Depression, her way of trying to make sure I had a secure job, figured that if she discouraged me, then I wouldn't end up as a, God forbid, starving singer trying to make it. So she very simply told me that I did not have a good voice until I believed her, and I just stopped singing. So I went to work, and she thought she had done a good job because I had a secure job, and I would put that singing nonsense away. So I joined this plan, and I lost 60 pounds. Boy, had I arrived. But then this little problem happened. I started eating these little desserts that were legal on this plan. And I found after a while that they tasted so good that there were two in the box. So they said to eat one at a time, but I said, well, maybe they meant one box at a time. Two desserts turned into, let's just eat the stack that's in the freezer, and that turned into, oh, to heck with this, I'm just going to go out to the candy store. And I was off to the races, and I gained 68 pounds back. This, in my mind, had never happened to anyone in the history of that weight loss program. I am unique, you know. And I went to that leader, and I began to cry. Because I said, I've gained 68 pounds back, and I don't know what to do. And she wrote down a phone number, and she said, this is a phone number to Overeaters Anonymous. She said, if you ever tell anyone that I gave you this number, I will lose my job, and I will hunt you down and kill you. Okay. I never actually got her last name, but I had her first name. I actually had one of my OA buddies look her up, and I found out she retired, so I asked God to bless her every day. She's living in retirement somewhere. So anyway, I called up OA Intergroup. Now, this was, you know, the Greater New York Metro Intergroup, and we had an intergroup office at the time. We no longer have the facilities because rent is way too high, so we rent a space somewhere else. But we had our own intergroup office, and this man answered the phone, and I told him, listen, I got this number. You know, and this was before the days of, you know, caller ID and Star 69, where you could call somebody back, and you know, this was this was 1990, and I said, I don't know if this is the right place for me. I Overeaters Anonymous, really? I've heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, well, why don't you just tell me what you ate yesterday? Tell me everything that you ate yesterday. You know, and I like to joke, but it probably, you know, was more, you know, fact than fiction. 10 minutes later, you know, he said to me, well, you know, maybe you'd like to come to one of our meetings and just try it. I was ready for him to say, oh my God, oh, you ate all of that. And I was ready to give him a couple of my very choice four-letter words, because after all, that was in my vocabulary for many years. And he didn't say, oh my God, how could you have done that? That was what I was expecting. So I could give him a choice word, hang up on him, and that would be it. And he invited me to come to a meeting. And I'm figuring, well, maybe, you know, this place meets once a week. Maybe he'll give me something next week. And he said, there's one, you know, there's not anything like right in your neighborhood, but on West 96th Street, there's a meeting on Saturday morning. And I was like, Saturday? And he started to chuckle because he probably figured I didn't want to go. But I was surprised that it was only 2 days away. And he gave me the address, and I went. And it was a beginner's meeting. And I will tell you that at this beginner's meeting, the way our traditional beginner's meetings are is, you know, we read the tools, or we discuss the tools, and then they'll talk about the first three steps. Not so at this beginner's meeting. There was a whoever the speaker was, she decided that out of the 55-minute meeting, she was going to qualify for 45 minutes. Yes, she did. And you know something? It's exactly what I needed, because, like I said, there's this word belligerent again. Had I sat there and heard, you know, we used the telephone, I would have said, yeah, you used the telephone. Do you have anything to give me here? Anonymity? Yeah, believe me, I don't want anybody to know that I came to Overeaters. Now, you know, let's not worry about that. I would have criticized and cut those little tools to little pieces. And instead, I was captivated by a story of a girl who said, you know, I'm a compulsive overeater and an exercise bulimic. And I said, I don't know what that is, but I know that that's me, because I never exercised without pulling a muscle, practically passing out. I was not safe with exercise, because I said, well, I ate all of this, I'm going to exercise it off. And I went with the gusto, and I'd be walking around holding my side, you know, rubbing my shoulders. I was not a healthy child. And by the time she was done with her story, all I heard was, I have a disease, and it's spiritual, emotional, and physical in nature. And I sat there and I said, oh my God, this is not my fault. I'm not lazy and slovenly and all these horrible words that I could think of. And selfish. Well, I was selfish, but, you know, we found that out. But I thought it was my fault, you know, because I had been, you know, I always had that message, like, leave some for others, you know? Yeah. And I was so blown away that I'm going to tell you, I never had an alcoholic blackout, but I don't even remember going home that day. It's like I walked out of that meeting like I was in a dream. And I went back to that meeting, and that girl and I started talking, and she started asking me about my childhood. Now, I'll tell you that I did suffer some abuse in childhood, and I also suffered neglect in childhood. I also didn't play like other children, especially after my mom died. And she asked me if I liked to color. And I said, no, I don't color, because when I color outside the lines, and all my little girlfriends, you know, used to laugh at me, so I stopped coloring. It's like if I did something that you know, that just didn't seem like the right thing. I wouldn't try it again. And she knew that I was so much in a fog and that I was so crazy that she knew that pointing out the huge steps and traditions on the wall were not going to do a thing for me at that point. And what she did was she brought in a coloring book and a box of 64 crayons. And she said, your assignment is each week you will bring me back a picture that you have colored in. And that was my very first step work, so to speak. She taught me how to be a child. And that's where people had to start with me. Okay? Now, I'm going to tell you, I've got all these books here, and I figured, you know, they're either going to get opened or they're not. But Voices of Recovery under January 1st is going to just give you a brief explanation. I'm just going to read a little bit of it, of why it took me 10 years to get a solid abstinence. It says, I continued, did they talk to anybody that knew me? I continued to eat the same way I had been eating. I ate all foods, but limited the quantities of my favorites. I didn't have any binge foods. No, not me. Of course, I still struggled, even though I was working the steps. I started eating more at meals. As long as it was part of a meal, I was still abstinent, right? Yeah, I only ate 3 meals a day. Boy, oh boy, what meals they were. And I, you know, it says eventually my higher power got a message through my food fog. He made me realize that I was playing with fire, still controlling my food. I had not taken step one. It took me 10 years, and I will tell you, people kept saying to me, let us love you till you learn to love yourself. I made up my own food plans. I never eliminated my favorite food plans. I could never hear people say, why don't you try to go to a nutritionist and let a nutritionist give you a food plan? Why am I going to pay someone who's going to tell me I can't eat my favorite foods anymore? That didn't make any sense to me. I was going to figure it out. And you know something, years later, I heard someone share at a meeting, and she said, I tried making up my own food plans, not realizing that a sick mind cannot make a healthy food plan. I said, oh gee, if only I'd known, you know. Yeah, no, I couldn't hear anything. I was truly, truly living in the fog. So over the 10 years, I would starve thinking that that was abstinence because I didn't feel as though I deserved to have more than like a saucer full of food. I figured that was abstinence, you know, not realizing I deserved to have a wonderful, beautiful plate full of food, you know. And then I couldn't understand why I couldn't maintain doing that, and then I would binge again. So I would lose weight and gain it and lose it and gain it, and I had sponsors that would pull me through the steps. And the steps all remained up here, but they never reached anywhere else. So I knew the steps. I could quote them chapter and verse, and I could not put them into practice because I was eating my brains out. And I went to a rehab. It turned out not to be the place for me. I did end up, actually it's really funny because that I needed to go to that particular rehab. They did not know what to do with a compulsive overeater. But my insurance said, you know, just, you know, find a place and we'll let you know if we'll pay for it. And they finally said yes to this place that I found. And I went out and I found out it was a psychiatric hospital with an eating disorder unit. And most of the people there were teenagers who were committed by their parents because they were either starving or binging to the point where they were nearly dead. And then there I was, the compulsive overeater. And I learned there that my aunt, during a family group session, I learned that my aunt, since she had lived through the Depression, that she really did love me because she put a roof over my head, she put good food on the table, she made sure I had clothes on my back, and the family therapist said, you know, the things that she told you, it may sound twisted, but that's the only way that she knew how to show her love. Mm-hmm. And so I walked out of that rehab knowing that I no longer had to hate that aunt. So I came out of there, and since I did not learn anything you know, because they put the food in front of me. I went back out and I thought, well, maybe I can, now that I'm clean for like 25 days, I can eat a little something. Yeah, I wasn't getting this thing, you know. So I went out and binged again within a couple of days. So this went on until it came to the point where I was telling somebody before that I once went to a party and there was like a handful of candy to bring home. It was the Halloween thing, and I figured, what can a handful do? And 100-pound gain later, I was saying, that's what it can do, you know? I decided to try another rehab because I had gotten up way past 250, and I'm only 5'2", and my blood pressure shot through the sky, and I was feeling really sick. The doctor was scared. He put me on blood pressure medication, and I said, I got to try another rehab, because it came to the point where I couldn't stop eating. I could not. Once I picked up the food in the morning, and I thought I was eating something healthy. See, that's the thing. I was not consulting a nutritionist. I thought I was having something healthy at breakfast, and once I picked it up, I ate all day. I ate out of my desk drawer. I ate out of the vending machines. I ate on the subway going home. I ate on the way home. Then I ate at home. I had no social life. I had no boyfriends, because that's a whole other fellowship I could have been in. But, you know, I was reduced to living for my food. You know, I felt the times when I was happy, it was because I had my favorite foods in the house. You know, that was my happiness. And so the night before I went, the night before I went to this other rehab, I had that moment. And I was sitting in the nail salon. I had fake nails because I bite my nails. And I sat there in the nail salon at 6:30. And at 10 o'clock at night, they were saying, Miss, we have to close the shop. And they thought I had fallen asleep, and I had gone to them week after week, and they said, oh, she's, you know, so heavy. And they figured, well, she's tired, she's worn out, let her just sleep for a while. I found out years later that I had had what they call a silent stroke. And I didn't know it. There was no, they call it a silent stroke because there's no paralysis. There's like no symptoms. And I kind of woke up from there, and I realized that I didn't know how to get home. And I called up an AA buddy of mine, and I said, I don't know how to get home. I'm in the nail salon. And he said, where are you? And I said, I'm on 190th Street. I lived on 188th Street, two blocks. We're not talking avenues and towns over, two blocks away, and I couldn't figure out how to get home. He lived in the suburbs in Westchester County, and he jumped in his car, and he flew down, I don't know how many traffic laws he broke. He zoomed down in the car, and he was going to be driving me to the airport the next morning, and I told him, I'm sick, I have a fever, I'm not going. And he said, look, he said, if you don't open the door at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning when I'm here to pick you up, I will break the door down, okay? So as I sat in my living room having my last meal, which came out of a package in a can, I suddenly knew with certainty that if I didn't stop eating, I was going to die. And I didn't realize that I had just had a stroke. And I finally, those steps started coming into my head, and I looked up, and I call my higher power God. I had created this wonderful, magnificent higher power. I was told, you know, create a wonderful higher power for yourself. And I looked up and I said, God, you've got to help me. I just don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. It was the first time I had ever earnestly prayed, and I tell you that I felt a presence come down and just sit next to me on the sofa. And I said, I am going to go. I am going to take every suggestion I'm giving, and I will not say no or make up excuses, but you have got to stop me from eating. Just give me one day with three meals, just one day. And I went to bed that night, and I did have 102 fever. I got sick all the time with the eating, all the gunk I was putting in me. I woke up feeling refreshed. I threw a couple of things in a bag. I hadn't even packed. I went to the airport. I went down there. I walked out of the plane. I sat down to have my first lunch, and I said, I want to go home. I mean, I hadn't even made it inside the facility. And I said, look, give it a shot. Just come inside with us. So I had my first abstinent meal on April 4th, 2000. The girl who made it for me was a girl who was assigned as my buddy, and she decided that since she didn't use salt, and believe me, I shouldn't have been using salt, she sprinkled it all with pepper, the only spice in life I will not eat. And because I'm such a people pleaser, she looked so like a puppy dog, so anxious, I said, this is great. So my next words to God were, you owe me big time. I've said that a lot over the years, even currently, which is kind of scary. So I was told to write my first step. And the person there said, everyone there was, you know, all the counselors there were in 12-step recovery. And they said, you know, do not go over 10 pages. And I said, 10 pages, is she kidding? So I picked up my higher power, picked up a plan of eating that they gave me, and began writing my first step all at the same time. Yeah. At the 10th page, I was writing around the borders of the page. And squeezing that last little word. And I read this first step. You see, because all those years I kept saying, well, I admit I'm powerless over food. Okay, you know, you get so big, you got to admit it. And someone said to me, you know, admitting it isn't just saying I'm powerless, it's feeling it. I admitted it. I admitted I am powerless over food. I had to truly feel it inside. And I read that first step, and the counselor said, oh, you need love and attention. And I'm telling you, you just don't know what that did to me. And then she said to everyone, let's give Andrea a lot of love and attention. Oh, my God. I was brought to OA meetings. I was brought to meetings of other food fellowships. See, because in this particular area, the OA meetings ran a certain way, but they know that not OA meetings in different parts of the country operate differently. And they said, we're going to eliminate these foods that are bringing on that craving. And you may not get the full support that you get out of OA, so we want you to go to OA, but we want you to find another fellowship too. Okay? So it's like, okay. But while I was down there, I yelled and I screamed. I shared this with a lot of people. I had anger. I had rage. I didn't have my food keeping me happy and calm anymore. And I would curse and I would yell, and they realized that my disease was at work, okay? They didn't know. They thought I was just trying to get thrown out. They realized my disease was at work because they said, do you want to stay or do you want to go? And when I thought they were going to throw me out, I broke down and cried. This was like after a couple of weeks, and I said, I've got nowhere else to go. And I heard them say, it's her insanity. She's not trying to manipulate us. That, the acceptance, was unbelievable. So after, on the third week, I'll say, I was sitting there in a group, and all of a sudden, I had this feeling, and it was bubbling and bubbling. I no longer had this food tamping down all the fears and the abuse and everything I had suffered. The reason I ate, I didn't want to feel anything, no emotions for me. Things started bubbling during this group, and by the end of the group, believe it or not, at 251 pounds, my head was between my knees, and I was just sobbing and just yelling, no! I just went completely nuts, and it's a good thing the therapy session was over. And that particular therapist happened to be an OA member. She brought me into the room, and she watched me, and then the shaking subsided, and she said, oh my God. She said, look in the mirror. And I looked in the mirror, and it had just stopped raining, and so it was cloudy, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I wear contact lenses, so they were cloudy. And I'm seeing like a pearlescent glow around the mirror, and she said, look at your eyes. and I looked at my eyes, and she said, I am seeing a child reborn in you. I thought, she's crazy, you know. And as I'm thinking, I don't see this. Why does she see this? I don't see this. All of a sudden, I felt like I had been floating, and my feet hit the ground, and I'm telling you, I saw a hand go like this, snap the fingers, and I heard a voice say, wake up! And for the first time in my life, I felt like I had landed. That I was truly awake. It was my spiritual awakening. And it was like, oh my God. I was reading Pass It On, and Bill Wilson talks about how he was suddenly on that mountaintop and he felt free. And that was his spiritual awakening, and I just knew. I said, oh my God, my entire nightmare life was just a dream, and I don't ever have to do that again. And I came home. I was told, just keep doing at home what you've done here. So I learned that sanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same results. So I came home, I went to my meetings, I went to work. When I had to pack my food, weigh it and measure it, do whatever I had to do, they called me, they asked me how I was doing. You know, I never stopped praying. I developed a relationship with this higher power that was unbelievable. I made a higher power that I could yell at, curse at, because that was quite often all I did. You know, I would ask for things, because I thought that's how to pray. I wouldn't get them, and I would curse at God and walk away. So I made my higher power someone that I could curse at and then turn around and say, yeah, okay, come on, let's go. You know, and not feel guilt or shame or I can't talk to my higher power anymore because I cursed at him. I made him someone with a very, very large, extreme sense of humor, you know, because you need it with me. I sometimes visualize him up there going, oh, and smacking himself in the head saying, she's at it again. You know, every morning I get in the shower and I say my third, seventh, and 11th step prayer, because the first place I ever remembered to pray was in the shower. People kept telling me, get on your knees and pray. I would get in the shower and say, oh, I forgot. Well, I'll pray tomorrow. It didn't occur to me I could just pray in the shower until one day I said, I could just pray here in the shower. So that has become a daily ritual for me, you know. My fourth step, I had a wonderful sponsor. Oh boy. I had a wonderful sponsor who said to me, don't even think about the fourth step. It's lots of fun. Don't listen to anybody say that it's scary. Now this sponsor was smart because this sponsor knew that there was no way. I had a lot of trouble reading because I was in a fog for quite a while. So I could not read the big book and I read bits and pieces of it, you know, and I had, you know, I knew like the columns in the fourth step, you know. I don't like Mrs. Brown. She's a nut. Someone once told me that's their favorite line in the big book because they don't like the big book. She's a nut. Yeah. So I knew all of that. So he said, this is where you get to complain about everybody. Get that list and go. And I said, yes. And I sat there. I can't. This is who I resent. This is the reason. This is what it affects. Yay. There's my three columns. And then I went to his house and he said, well, now we're going to do the fourth column. And I said, what's that? And he said, you're part in it. Oh boy, did he trick me. Yeah, so we sat there and saw my part in it. And something amazing happened. I went from being a victim to being a survivor because I could claim a part in it. I said, this is what I did. And then he said, now we're going to see what kind of defects of character do you see here? So we wrote down a list of defects of character. He said, now what would you, are you ready to get rid of these? Oh, I was so ready to get rid of them. I was like, yeah, I'm ready. Yeah. You know, I hear a lot of people say I wasn't ready. I was ready. So then we wrote down the assets we wanted to have them, you know, replaced with. So I went in there to turn over a fourth step, which I thought was going to be a real good complaining list. And I walked out of there owning my resentments, finding my defects of character, writing down the assets, saying the seventh step prayer on my knees with this guy, and leaving there to work on my eighth step. Wow, how did this happen? So you know something? I made the list of persons I had harmed, and I was not, I had trouble with the part of being willing to make amends to them all. And he said, but that's not a problem, because before you make any amends at all, you're going to discuss them with me, you know? And so, you know, I'm just talking about like the first time I ever like really went through the steps thoroughly. I've been through the steps many, many times. But I made that list, and as I made each amends, I felt free. I felt free. I felt free. There's that word, free. I like that word, free. I always wanted to be free. I thought free was living alone in a cabin in the woods. I'm a city girl, okay? No one around me. I would like grow my own food, and I would never have to talk to anyone again, and I could be free. You know, that was my idea. I found freedom in making these amends, okay? And then I came to 10, 11, and 12. I will tell you that my favorite principle is perseverance. And that's in the 10th step. And it's because I just kept coming. I kept coming. There was a time I almost left, but I kept coming. Even with a 100-pound weight gain, I kept coming, you know. And people loved me till I learned to love myself. I had a girl, after a while, you know, I went through 10, 11, and 12. Service is my favorite tool. My favorite step is the third step, because it took me so long to get it. I was like, I don't know what that means, turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And as soon as I discovered that it was just asking God to show me his will and bringing him into my day and seeing the miracles happen, that became my favorite step. And my favorite tradition is the third tradition, because I thought people that had more money than me were better than me, because that's how I was raised. And in OA, I don't know if I'm sitting next to a millionaire or if I'm sitting next to, you know, someone who, you know, maybe just, you know, came out of a homeless shelter. I don't know if I'm sitting here with a PhD sitting next to me or a lawyer, because we're anonymous. We have a common bond. I don't have to pay to join this club. That's another great tradition, the seventh tradition. I have done service putting out chairs, and I've put out service going to the World Service Business Conference. Of course, there were a whole lot more stories I was going to tell, but there are some that I'm just letting go. I do want to tell you, though, because it's very important, that I have found a lot of answers to questions and problems in the rooms. I found out that I really needed to go to college, because my job told me, you've gone as high as you can and you have got to go to school. You know, because when I started working, you didn't need college. And that belligerence, you know, I looked up at God and I said, okay, here's what I want, because they told me I gotta go to college. I want a school that's small. I want a pretty campus. I want small classes. I want teachers who will teach me and not just throw a book at me and tell me to get a tutor. You know, I have to work during the week, so I want to be able to take my classes on the weekend, so you got to give me good weekend classes. And then I was like, go ahead, find that for me. You know, this is how I talk to my higher power. So my higher power decided, okay, oh, I'm going to give you a good one. I visualized this campus that while I was in high school, one of the girls had brought me, she had driven me up there. It was in Tarrytown, not in the city, and I don't drive. And she was thinking of going to school there, and I thought it was the most beautiful, sweetest looking school I had ever seen, and I had that picture in my mind. And I had called a couple of schools, and I called up this school, and I said, do you have classes on the weekend for people that have to work during the week? She said, oh yes, we have a weekend college program. It's specifically for people who've been out of school for a while and who want to go to college. And we offer all sorts of degrees here. She said, and in addition to that, we have dormitory rooms, so you can come up and spend the entire weekend here with us in a dorm room and be a college kid. Oh my God, oh my God. So I went into the OA room and I said, I'm scared to go. I'm scared. It's up in Tarrytown. I don't drive. I have to take the Metro North. And this girl came over to me who I had never seen before, and she said, I'll go up there with you. And she went up there with me. She had me sign the papers. On the train back, she said, you weren't getting out of there alive without signing those papers because I am a teacher. And she said, you kept coming into the meeting saying, I can't go to college because I'm stupid. She said, but you kept saying that you weren't able to pay attention in school, and that's not stupid. That's not being able to pay attention. And now you've got some recovery. And I went to school, and I was on the dean's list 3 times. I changed my major. I changed my major because I was taking business, and I discovered I didn't really like business. And one day I was editing this piece in English, and it said, don't go to school for what you feel you should be going to school for. Go for what you want. It's like, who's talking to me here, you know? So I actually became the first weekend college student because that school got taken over by a top social work school, and I transferred, you know. I was the first weekend college student to get into what they call the accelerated program, so that I did my... I graduated with my master's degree 1 year after I got my bachelor's degree. I was going to my master's classes, my bachelor's classes, working full-time and doing an internship at the same time. Do not ask. This is only by the grace of God. I have a whole new career today. I practice all of my tools, all of my steps. You know, I am happy, joyous, and free today. I was going to read, you know, it's funny because I brought all this stuff up here, so I'm probably not going to open any of it, but I have to tell you, a sponsor and I just were going through the steps again, and when she said, okay, it's time to list the defects of character, she pulled out legal paper, and she very happily said, I'm over in the second column now. You know, just when you think you've got your, you know, resentments in hand and your defects of character... You know, so I keep this in my notebook because I've been writing their opposites. And yeah, and it's funny because this time it's had to go slower, you know, because I'm having more creative answers to, you know, defect is this, what is the asset to this? And I'm finding answers I never saw before, and some of them I'm seeing in books. You know, sort of like people-pleasing, and someone said, I don't people-please anymore, I God-please. And I said, oh, I'm putting down God-please. You know, I'm not going to put down, oh, I need to be more assertive. You know, God-please instead of people-please. And she told me, pray, you know, you can pray for what you want. I said, I thought I was only supposed to pray for God's will for me and the power to carry it out. And she very nicely said, yeah, that too, you know. She said... But, you know, Andrea, you can ask for what you want. You know, I very belligerently threw up, well, I got to go to college. And she said, pray for what you want. And you know something? If your higher power has something better for you, you're going to get something better. But you can ask, it says in one of our, in our 11th step, in the OA 12 and 12, it says, what do we say to God? And it's like, we say whatever we want. And I'm like, wow. I'm still learning. My abstinent date is April 4th, 2000. I'm maintaining right now 119-pound weight loss. You know, I do service. Like I said before, I practice all my tools. I am blessed with a sponsee who has a lot of similar attitudes that I had when I came in. Oh, I know this. Oh, I got this. Oh, I'm just fine. And I'm looking up saying, that's not funny. You know, I have a sponsor who I absolutely love. She's been my friend since the beginning. We met through doing service. I was answering phones at Intergroup. I would have a question. Someone would say, "I'll call her. She knows everything." You know, and her number was up on the wall. And I'd call her every week, and I had a different question for her. She very patiently answered my question. And one day she came into the office. She introduced herself, and I said, oh, I'm Andrea, I'm a beginner. She said, I recognize the voice. You know, We go to World Service together, and she, the last time I got elected to go to World Service, the way she put it to me was, I'm going to World Service, so you'd better get yourself elected. What should I do? Like, give out money or something and pay people to vote for me? She said, I don't care how you do it, you got to go to World Service. And I'm like, this is what I'm blessed with. This is it, you know, I need, this is my sense of humor. I absolutely love her. I love her, and she loves me. You know, I have found nothing but love and acceptance in this program. You know, emotionally, I've got a full array of emotions. A full array of emotions. When I am feeling an emotion I don't like, I remember, this too shall pass. I was told that, this too shall pass. I stick with my slogans because when I came in, that's all I could hear, and that's all that would stick. You know, emotional, physical, spiritual recovery, it is a three-legged stool, because when I tried to just diet, it fell over. When I said, oh, God will take care of me even though I'm eating this and this, it fell over, because I sat back and said, okay, God, you do the work. You know, and emotionally, well, you know, I had to put down the food, and emotionally my emotions came up, and I had to simply sit with them and feel them. You know, I needed someone to tell me what my emotions were. I'd sit there and I'd say, oh, I'm feeling this way and that way. And someone actually told me, well, you know something, you're happy and you're sad at the same time. And I'm like, really? Can that happen? And she said, apparently so. You know, and then sometimes I was angry and depressed at the same time. I mean, I actually needed someone to tell me what I was feeling, because the food was my replacement for emotions. So today, when I heard happy, joyous, and free, I thought that meant all the time. And then someone said, no, Andrea, not all the time. You know, all the promises have come true for me at one time or another. You know, that I'm living in those promises. So I live in my steps, I live in my tools. I know I do talk way too much.
No,
not Andrea. Do you know when I came here last night, I heard people talking on the first step and I was completely blank, and I said, oh, that's just great. I have absolutely nothing to say on the first step. And I went out this morning and I prayed and I was like, what are you doing? You know, I get confused sometimes, and when I get overwhelmed, I can't think. And I said to God, how can I talk about this first step, but then talk about the threefold recovery? And the way my mind was seeing it was, there is no recovery when you're talking about powerlessness and unmanageability. And I heard this voice say to me, Andrea, you share your experience, strength, and hope, and then you talk about what happens after you tell your craziness, then you talk about how you got the sanity. And I was like, oh, okay, thank you. You know? And that's what I had to do. So I was silent last night, and I sure made up for it today. This is the most wonderful, enlightening, beautiful retreat. I've heard things here that I haven't heard before. And it's sort of like the big book. Every time I open up the big book, there's something in there. And I'll bet your money it wasn't in there yesterday. They keep changing this thing on me. I keep opening it up, and there's something different in there every time. You know? And I just love being here, and I do want to just refer people. I'm going to end now. Everybody pick up your Voices of Recovery and read July 23rd, because on July 23rd, it talks about freedom in each one, how freedom comes in each one of the steps. And someone had read that at a meeting once, and I wanted a shout out. Hallelujah. So what I will do is I will end on that note and say thank you all for inviting me here. Thank you, Margaret, for inviting me to keynote tonight, and thank you guys for listening to me.